This is a production of Cornell University.
As we're getting settled, I would like to start with roll call for the voting members. Are the humanities Kristen? Angie?
Here.
Becca?
Here.
Life Sciences, Alexa?
Here.
Kalia? Cinnamon? Physical Sciences and Engineering, Josh? Dimitri? Jared? Nathan? Final Schools, Alexei? Sarah? Elizabeth, Anna, James,
here.
Nick, Social Sciences, Margaret, Mo,
here.
I'm here, Wendy,
here.
Masters, Cara,
here.
Caitlin, Shag, and Davis. Okay, so with that, I would like us to approve our minutes from our last meeting. Is there any comments or changes?
Motion to approve the meeting.
Okay, is there a second?
A second.
Okay, so is there any objection to approving the minute as it is? Seeing none, the minutes are approved. And today we have presentations from the graduate school. Dean Newth and Dean Kafka are here today, and they're going to talk about the graduate assistantship and fellowship packages. And we're trying out something that's a little new in terms of format. They'll give a brief presentation based on this handout. And then, you know, if you have any clarification questions that is pertaining to this handout, we'll take on one or two questions, but they will be staying for the 30-minute division breakout right after, and they'll be making their rounds to your various division breakouts. So you'll get to ask more detailed questions and get to share more information with them. Okay? And hopefully we'll also be doing that for in the future for other GCI-related guest speakers. So without further ado, Dean Kafka and Dean Newth.
Well, thank you for inviting us and allowing us to have a little conversation with you about graduate stipend rates. Let me start by just offering a little context in how we use these discussions to inform recommendations that ultimately are advanced to the senior leadership of the university and to the Board of Trustees each year as we set stipend rates for the upcoming academic year. So our approach has been to provide to compile data on a number of different parameters and metrics and seek feedback from different stakeholder groups to help us understand how Cornell's stipend rates are positioning our students and positioning our graduate programs on a couple different fronts. So obviously, one of the most important things and the reason we're here today is to understand how the stipend rates support students and what your experience has been with them. Are there opportunities? Are the stipend rates set at the right place so that students can pursue their degree without undue financial stress? And at the same time, we need to balance a few other competing needs in some cases, or just other needs. So one of them is making sure that our programs are able to effectively recruit students, that our stipend rates compare favorably with peers. And so we ask our departments and DGSs, graduate fields, what their experience has been on the admissions front. And we also, in a little bit less in recent years, but historically, we've also needed to work with faculty who are writing grants and bringing in dollars to support students and understanding what stipend rates impact on their ability to successfully secure grants. And because of that, we have our kind of a broad approach that we use to gathering feedback. So the handout in front of you, you're seeing a number of different measures, and I'm going to walk through them quickly, and then we'll have time to answer questions in the large format, and then in smaller divisional breakouts. So the on the first page, the data that I'd like to draw your attention to. First of all, under current rates, these are just putting in kind of direct terms what the current year stipends are. So for those of you who are not familiar with the graduate funding model, primarily for doctoral students, but in some cases for funded master's students, the university sets a minimum stipend for the 9-month academic year. This year it's $26,426. So this is only for the academic year. That doesn't include summer funding, although many students do receive summer funding. But in terms of what we're actually talking about here, we're talking about the 9-month rate. The summer fellowship rate, and for students in the humanities and humanistic social sciences, this is an important number because those students receive SAGE fellowships and receive a $5,568 summer fellowship. So the base academic year plus the summer fellowship, that's kind of the full year package for students in humanities that receive summer funding. And then in other fields, it's more customary for students to stay on assistantships throughout the whole 12-month year. And in that case, the 9-month rate extrapolates out into the summer, and that total 12-month rate is $35,235. So again, that's just kind of setting the landscape. That's where we are for this year's academic year minimum stipend rates. Some fields and departments are able to pay slightly higher than that. Most pay at the base, and that is for assistantships, CA, RA, GRA, and graduate assistantships. So for many years, what we've done is we've benchmarked Cornell stipend against a group of peer schools. We have a data sharing arrangement with an Ivy Plus group, so this is kind of our the Ivy schools plus a few other large R1 elite research universities. And as part of that agreement, we commit to not sharing their data publicly, so the data you're seeing in the table on the first page is masked. We don't show the names, but what you'll see here is that Cornell's stipend rate, and in the black and white copies, I know it's a little dark, but that's at 26, 426. Cornell's rate is near the middle of the pack for the peers that have numbers after them. Those are the Ivy Plus peers. And we've also included in this peer group a number of flagship state institutions and graduate programs at medical schools that kind of encompass more of our life science fields. And perhaps not surprisingly, what you'll know is that you'll know that the Ivy Plus peers tend to all be a bit higher than the state schools. And Cornell is in the middle of the Ivy Plus and a bit higher than the state schools on gender terms. So that's just how we position amongst a group of peers. The next page, however, includes two different trend lines. And there's a couple of takeaways I'll just offer here. The first plot shows RA and GRA stipends. And what you'll see is that all of them have increased over years. This is perhaps not so unexpected. Cornell's stipend rate is the solid line. And it's fairly close to the middle of the pack. The data here are a bit noisier because the self-reported data, it's a lot of normalizing and the way that schools use different methodologies. We don't all compare apples to apples here. But in general terms, Cornell is currently near the middle of the pack. You'll notice there are a few outliers that have really accelerated upwards. And also you'll notice around 2003 or 4, there was a period where just prior to that, Cornell's rate had dipped quite low by comparison to peers. And we had several years of aggressive increases in the stipend rate. And the lesson that we at the grad school have internalized from that is it's important to keep Cornell's stipend rates near the middle of the pack, because if we fall below that and have to catch up, it's a financially really challenging proposition for faculty who are supporting students on grants to have double-digit stipend increases for a couple of years to catch back up. So we've taken a rather conservative, steady approach to inflating stipend rates each year for cost of living increases, but also so that we stay in line with all the other schools that our applicants are looking at. The bottom plot is a similar one. This is for TA stipend rates. I'll note that at Cornell, we use the same assistantship minimum for GA, GRAs, RAs, and TAs. We don't break them apart. Many of our peers do, and because of that, there are some differences in how the trends break out. But again, you'll see that Cornell is near the middle of that group of peers. So if you'll flip over to the next page, this is an area where it's been really helpful to get student input in the past, and we have sought out student input specifically to understand what does it mean in real terms for students who are supporting themselves financially with these stipends. What we've done is we've modeled two different hypothetical budgets, and we know there's no single budget that can kind of accurately represent all students here. But we use this analysis to do a couple of things. One of them is to engage in a conversation with faculty who might not always really understand what the cost of living for students are here. And so this is a way for us to kind of talk through what the expenses would be for two kind of hypothetical student cases. So student A represents a humanities student who receives, for example, a teaching assistantship during the year and the summer SAGE fellowship. Their monthly income across that 12 months will be about $2,666. And then we plug in numbers that we can collect off of sources that we can actually quantify. So we look at what is the expected taxes, what's the average cost for clothing, books, food, using data that we can replicate year to year. And that helps us track trends to see what students' purchasing power looks like each year, because even if we're doing well in relative relation to our peers, if students' absolute purchasing power is dropping, we know that's going to create hardships for students. So this is a way of kind of ground truthing this based on the local Ithaca economy, where we know rents are high. And other expenses can be high too. The second column, the student B, is representative of a student who's on a 12-month assistantship, so you'll see there's a slight difference in the average monthly stipend in the dark bar at the top of that chart. And the costs for this hypothetical student are similar. We've represented rent as a range, and that's based on data from both local off-campus rents and also on-campus rents, so that we factor both of those in when calculating the range. And really, the important number that we've looked at is the bottom line. It's how much after fixed expected expenses are covered, how much is left in the student's pocket to actually pay for all the other things that we know you still have to pay for. And this is where we see some students reporting that there's pressures and it can be actually really difficult. Other students tell us that, you know, that they've been able to budget around these and can support their household needs. The next set of data that we look at is a comparison with a number of different wage and living wage metrics that are relative to upstate New York and Ithaca in particular. So what we've done here is we've compiled numbers on the Tompkins County living wage, which is a statistic that's put out by, it's on a website, it's generated by MIT, and what it factors in is what are local costs for, this would typically be for community members in the workforce, what do you need in order to support a household on a living wage. And what you'll see is that the Tompkins County living wage for a single adult is $26,582. So that's very close to our base 9-month assistantship. So, and it actually, what it doesn't take into account here is that the students who are on those assistantships also have health insurance covered and don't have FICO taxes withheld. So in general, I think we're the 9-month rate comes out favorably to the living wage. Students with summer support jump up a bit higher than that. Also, just for comparison, there's some data points on here around poverty wage, federal poverty wage for students with, or for adults with a child or two adults and having our children at home. And then also the New York State minimum wage for a full-time 40-hour-a-week employee, $21,000. $632. So again, throwing a lot of numbers at you, you can digest those. But in the points below, I think one of the areas that we've been keen to look at recently is understanding what the impact of stipends are on students with families. This is an area where we've heard a lot about from a number of different student groups. A metric that gives a little bit of sense around that is households with two graduate students, both on 15-hour-a-week, 12-month appointments, exceeds the living wage for a family of five. So this would be two students, both on assistantships, with three children. You'll still come out ahead of the living wage for a family of five. So again, that's a little bit of just just kind of gives you some data to think through, like what this experience will be for students with families. The final comments I'll make are really on the back page, just related to more national trends. So in this case, we've had a couple years where the inflation rate, the consumer price index, has been very flat. We haven't seen much upward growth in that. We are starting to see, and I'm sure you hear about it in the political discussion, there are more signs of inflation, interest rates are creeping up. So the consumer price index for the preceding 12 months has been about 2.3%, or 2.2% when you take out food and energy, and Social Security benefits are going up for seniors and others who are on Social Security benefits by 2.8% next year. So again, that's the national landscape. That kind of informs, all those points inform where we look for what direction we should be going with our stipend rates at Cornell. And then the last point is really around the, and I think we've got some data merged a little bit in here, but the final point that I'd like to point out is it's the table that shows from 2010 to 2018 the number of students doctoral students who've taken out educational loans as part of their doctoral time. And what we're seeing is very low numbers. You'll see that in 2018, 3% of doctoral students took out educational loans. 3% of graduating students had educational loan debt from their doctoral studies at Cornell. So of the 540 doctoral students that graduated in 2018, that's a total of 15 people had educational loan debt from that period. So again, what we use that to think about are students unable to support themselves on their stipend and therefore having to supplement with loans, and you'll see that the trend is moving in a better direction, which is trending slightly downward. There was, in 2011 and 13, we were above 10% of students. So this is kind of a quick summary of where the data that we use to think about stipend rates, but the questions for you are, what's your experience with it? Is it meeting your basic needs? Are there comments that would be helpful for us as we develop recommendations and advance them up through the university leadership? So I'll stop there.
So we'll be taking in general questions if you want to clarify anything that has anything to do with this presentation. And then if you have more detailed things to share or ask, we can do it in the division later. I have Eugene.
Thank you for this, and I really appreciate it that the graduate school is very mindful about the needs of students to live, and is trying to at least match that common counter. But I noticed that the monthly budgets that are here are omitting a couple driving things for important things, and the balance at the bottom is a little bit low relative to those sometimes. One is car loans, so students that need a vehicle but need to have a loan for that, I can easily cover that gap very quickly. And then something we hear from students, it doesn't mention travel in that balance, we hear from students all the time, especially from low FCS backgrounds, that they can't afford to go to conferences or other professional development events because there's, they have to pay that upfront, for example. And I'm wondering whether there's ways to take those types of changes into account. Another thing we hear about technology, that students might not have laptop computers and can't afford to buy one on this stipend. Other ways to maybe have need-based grants for certain things that might bridge the gap for students that don't come in with certain advantages. Some people might assume that everyone has a laptop, that's not true.
Sure. Well, I think let me offer in a less specific way, just a comment about the first question around a car loan. What we've tried to do with this is to quantify costs that we can standardize and actually measure for the local area over time. So there are many costs that we know and expect and are not trying to discount. What we're trying to measure here is the things that would be more considered fixed costs that in some way or form students will have to address: housing, food, the basics. Not to say that car is not within that. It's just a harder one that there's a lot of different ways that students might need to address the cost of transportation, right? And that can look very different. For some students, that could be regular bus trips to the city, and other students, it could be owning a car. In some cases, it could be bus pass. You know, so not that we're discounting that, but I think your point about travel being needing to be a significant cost is a significant cost for students is not missed. And you're also your point about the basics like technology, absolutely. And I think that's something we can think about.
You can also mention that there are conference travel grants.
Yes, and to your point, we do have both research travel grants and conference travel grants that can help subsidize the cost of travel. But again, we hear from students that that's an area where more attention is always appreciated.
Ashen, and then Kavya, and go ahead. Yeah, Ashen.
I think you mentioned that this also applies to some graduate students. So can you clarify, are this being graduate students pursuing masters or professional study programs? Do they factor into this or not?
So the question is, does this apply to master's students? And really the defining factor is anyone who's offered an assistantship. So that's any position that's classified in the university as a teaching assistant, research assistant, graduate research assistant, or graduate assistant. So those four position titles, those appointment titles, those would be subject to the minimums and applied here. So some students in Masters of Science and Masters of Arts are offered them. It's less common in professional master's programs. There are some special cases, but in most cases, they're not typically made available to professional masters.
So would there be anything done to, I guess, help these fresh students that don't have to practice themselves?
Yeah, so let me just comment on that. So the follow-up question was, is there anything being done for professional master's students funding? That's really in the purview of each of the deans that oversee professional master's programs. And there is attention every year. Student debt loads are measured, and particularly professional schools are trying to take the actions they can to either hold their tuition steady, hold the increases of tuition low, and also to provide more financial aid, particularly through raising funds from donors. So yes, deans are aware of that and sensitive to it, but it's a different funding approach because most professional master students aren't on assistantships of this type.
Kavya and then Keaton.
Thanks for the presentation. I have two quick questions. The second is a discussion. If you want to leave that for the group that's later, that's fine. The question is, do you have any idea of how this grade term by discipline, whether that people are getting graduate assistantships, 9 months, 12 months, paid shifts, how that breaks down by critical sciences?
Sure, we do have some data on that. So there, without going in too far into it, I think that we see that there are some very, in most cases, students are fully supported doctoral students in the first 5 to 6 years of their program, tend to be fully supported, often and almost always as part of a commitment made at the time of admission during the 9-month academic year. Summer funding is more variable. There are patterns, there are some differences. That's an area that the university has been actively working on in order to kind of raise the floor for summer. And I think we have seen some positive trends in that front. But we don't see any significant deviation below these levels by discipline, and we do monitor and enforce this. And if we find that there's misunderstandings or fields that are certainly at the, from the 9-month academic year, we have a pretty tight enforcement regime. So, I wouldn't expect that we would see any deviation lower than this. But again, you may see some fields that pay slight supplements, and if they do that, it's typically when they have a specific group of peers that are also doing that, and they feel they need to in order to be competitive.
Okay, clarification. What I'm trying to get at is my assumption would be that the life sciences tend to get more ratios for students in the humanities.
Oh, yes, correct. Absolutely.
And that can affect workload, like, in incredible amounts.
Sure. So to that point, though, specifically, so both an RA ship and a TA ship are defined the same in terms of 15 hours per week of service on average. Now, a GRA, which is a slightly different position, that's actually when the assistant ship aligns directly with the student's own dissertation research. So in those cases, the question around workload is a little bit more nuanced because the activities of the assistant ship are in essence the same things that a student on a TA appointment would also be doing. So yes, there are some patterns, but those are largely driven by the sort of the nature of students working in areas that are funded research, right? Grant-funded, sponsored research versus other areas that are more, even nationally, are more supported typically as on fellowship and teaching assistantships. And I'll also note that in the humanities and social sciences, which tend to be the fields where there's fewer RA resources or GRA resources, the university offers enhanced fellowship resources so that those students typically receive 2 years of fellowship and 4 summers, which are not available in the STEM and life science fields. So try to help compensate.
Okay. So I'll have Caitlin, Dietrich, and then Becca, and then we'll go.
I'll keep it brief.
Okay.
I have 2 questions, if that's okay. Hopefully they shouldn't be too long. First, I wanted to clarify something you said about professional master's students. I'm in a professional master's program, and my understanding of the way TAs work in our program is that they're paid hourly, and I'm wondering how that fits into these guidelines and these standards.
Yeah, great question. So we should differentiate between what is officially appointed as a teaching assistant, your job title in the system, in Workday, is listed as teaching assistantship, and what is casually referred to as, I'm TAing for this class, right? What we typically see in professional programs is that students have appointments that are called a teaching specialist or a GTRS, or some other job title, position title, that is not, in fact, a teaching assistantship as defined by this. And there's a University Policy 1.3 kind of breaks out what the parameters are for professional students to be eligible to hold a true teaching assistantship assignment. And typically they're only used in very limited situations. So probably what you're talking about are hourly student appointments that just don't fall into this definition.
Okay. Yeah. And my second question is, for these assistantships that you're talking about, is any graduate student eligible, or is the eligibility requirements the same for international students and Chinese students?
The eligibility requirements are essentially the same for all of these appointments between the U.S. and international students. There is a language assessment requirement, so for students who aren't first speakers of English, there's a language assessment to ensure that their language skills are, adequate and the students that they're teaching will be able to understand the content. But other than that, I don't know. Yeah.
And just to add in about the difference between the hourly versus an assistantship, all of these assistantship packages and fellowship packages include not only the stipend that we've been talking about, but also include the student health plan, fully paid, and also include tuition, fully paid. And that's where it really gets into distinguishing what's an assistantship or fellowship versus what is one of the hourly positions.
I have 2 questions. So my first question was, I'll just ask in sequence, my first question was, does this compare for external campuses? So if I go to New York Tech, for example, how do these rates change?
Right. I don't know the exact number. New York, the Tech campus for funded doctoral students who are on the Tech campus do receive a supplement to compensate for the higher cost of living in the New York City area. I think it's on the order of, it's on the order of $4,000 or $5,000. It's a bump just because it is quite a bit more expensive.
Cool. And then my second question was, I noticed that the federal poverty wage is fairly hyper-neurotypical child. I guess the thing that I'm concerned about is you mentioned we are up to five students, is what we're about in terms of working wage here, or up to five children in terms of working wage here, if both parents are working at this rate.
Well, yeah, a house, so the bullet point that I put in there is a family of five, so two students on assistantships with three children. We were looking at that as probably representative of our, you know, that we have some student families that have three children at home. And so the question is, would Cornell's stipend package be adequate to provide for such a family? And we think, based on this, we think yes, but again, that's part of why we're here.
Yeah, but
it's true
what I wanted to ask is I know the grant for Dave, like, the child program is going to provide a little bit of a boost, but clearly, I mean, this is going to be more expensive, and so I'm worried about single parents with, like, multiple children. It's like, I know a population that isn't super well represented here, because that's a lot of time. But I was wondering if there are any data on single parents in particular, or parents parents working here where their spouse is not working.
So we definitely have situations with students who are here with a spouse who's not working or can't work, and this is common for international students when the spouse doesn't have work authorization in the U.S. And so the data we presented, I think there's a couple of points that might touch on that. Certainly, above the poverty wage, but I think we would all aspire to higher standards than that. And so the question is, how do we compare for that single parent or one working parent or one student on assistantship and with a family of one or more, and especially if they have a spouse or partner who's not able to work. So again, but that would be something that would be helpful for us to hear if you can reflect on that. Mm-hmm.
And one last question from Becca.
This is quick, but when you were presenting the data on the first page, I was really intrigued by the fact that it sounds like we are okay with being in the middle of the pack for our IB Plus cohort when it comes to type of funding, and I'm curious why.
I'm not saying that with a judgment that that's where we should or shouldn't be. I'm just saying that I think that the factors that have entered into previous discussions we've had are, what are the costs of living in Ithaca relative to some of our peers? So, for example, maybe not surprisingly, there are some numbers here that represent Palo Alto and Cambridge and others where we know that there's very high cost of living. And I don't mean to say that that's what the policy should be, but I think that in practical terms, we realize it's problematic to be at the bottom, and I think probably students agree.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. Thanks, Jason. As Jason indicated at the beginning, there's a whole range of factors that have to be considered that relate to financial matters. For many faculty who are particularly in the life sciences, but to some degree in the social sciences, their competitors in terms of the competitive schools are state land grant institutions. And so when they're putting in grants that have $30,000 costs for stipends, and other schools are putting in PIs, but those schools are putting in grants for $20,000 or $18,000 stipends, and then reviewers take a look at that, those Cornell PIs are dinged for those proposals. So it's a balancing act, quite honestly, in terms of, and also when you look at the endowments and the endowment per student of Harvard, Princeton, Yale versus Cornell, the resources that are available are quite different among this range of schools. So if we can maintain at the middle of that group in terms of competitive financial concerns, we may be doing pretty well, actually, because we are not near the middle in terms of endowment. I think nationally, we're endowment per student, we're something like 25th, 26th, not in the top, Ivy League.
Okay, so D3 here.
I have a follow-up question.
Okay, just a very short one. very short. Okay.
I heard some medical expenses are listed here. I know that there are some expenses that are listed in the terms like a dental fee.
So we don't put in medical as a fixed line because that can vary considerably among different students. What we're trying to convey here is that in the case of student A, where the remaining budget after our kind of projected fixed costs are covered, that if a student had selected a higher cost housing option, that student would essentially have $1, no dollars left per month to cover any discretionary cost. So really what I think the takeaway message for this, at least the way we look at it internally, is that what we're essentially saying is a student A would have to make some decisions on the fixed portion of their budget in order to have, we know you will have to have discretionary income available to cover some of those costs. So what we're essentially saying is that student A really would have struggle on the stipend to pay the higher end of the housing costs and still have leftovers. So we're, again, trying to illustrate what choices in the real world students are having to make because we know that you do have to cover all these discretionary costs. So again, this is kind of a modeling exercise, and I think that Cornell Health can probably provide some data. I know that there's some folks here that are on the advisory committee, but to look at what actual costs are for students, we haven't factored those in, again, because they're not a fixed cost, they're pretty varied.
Okay, so let's now move on to our division breakout. Andy, where should people move?
So as always, professional schools up in the front, social science to my right, humanities to the left, life sciences up over that end, and physical science outside.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So where would you like
to start?
You are all of
us. Seconds to get to where they're going. Yeah.
I think that Oh, okay. even though our students feel that they have a lot of respect for us, I feel like I think shorthand is still here. So,
under
yeah. That's also more of a Actually, I didn't have one problem, and it was my friends didn't do any after work, because they're trying to do it. So I kind of $100 for the hotel. And still, you weren't able to move into, what, 5 months after? Well, yeah, 5 months after you were supposed to.
I was only a week late. Yeah. 4 years. I've probably been in there just because I'm in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
But just
having someone
that
you want to
call,
what's really
looking at
me? What's it? Do you guys get like Google stuff
at the right
time? Do you get both?
Yeah, it's just a little rough. Do you guys have an internal shuttle or something? Because your school is also fast, right? Like, you're listening to the barns and stuff? We all have really tough ways to get to the barns. We can walk in the
it would be like this outside, or a star.
Oh, no, that's wrong.
Thank you.
I have it planned out and memorized.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the next one. I'm going to go to the next one. Yeah.
So we have to quickly resume our meeting. So next on our agenda for today is we have to elect a new appropriations chair and a new finance commission chair. These two committees are the only two committees of the GPSA that run on, their chairmanship runs from January to January. So because it requires a lot of transition, the idea is to have the most recent retiring chair still be available in the spring semester for a smoother transition. So since today is the last meeting of this semester, we have to elect this, and we have, and I hope everybody received an email saying that this is happening. Anyone need to send this?
Wednesday.
Okay. So do we have the appropriations chair and finance commission chair here? Okay, so can someone from the appropriations chair very briefly, Matt, describe what the AC does and what the chair does?
Absolutely. Appropriations committee is the implies appropriate to the budget. We handle the GPSA's internal budget. We handle the activity fee on a bi-yearly basis, so this year we have the fall spring, students in the fall, the next activity fee under your purview. We also oversee bilateral orders and handle all the students as they come up. In the spring, the primary obligations of the committee are revising the GPSAFC guidelines and starting to gather the applications for the next bilateral cycle. Have any other questions as well?
Okay. And
do
we have the activity chair here?
Okay, so the finance commission pretty much just allocates budgets to every registered graduate professional club organization on campus. And we also deal with their tier placement, so kind of deciding what organizations get what amount of money.
Any questions for AC or Nancy? Okay, I don't see anyone. Please shout in. Okay.
This is basically giving you guys more time to talk. How much responsibility do you think?
How much responsibility? Yes. Okay.
It's a lot of continual responsibility, I would say. Always addressing emails. Being very active on email is key. And just being able to meet with different organizations, answering their questions. And then otherwise, we do budgets roughly every month for 2 or so hours. So that commitment is due. huge, but just preparing for those meetings and then being continuously available to answer questions.
So that's for Axie.
It's not necessarily I'm not the chair, but I can say appropriations meet, especially during the bylaw year, it'll meet 2-3 times a month. You have a lot in terms of going on the packets, working with organizations. It's not a small undertaking, especially as you're looking to start the bylaw process. And you have very spent a lot of time on it.
Okay, perfect. Any other questions? I'm raising my hand. Okay. I haven't seen anyone, so I'm opening the floor for nominations. First for appropriations chair. Is there anyone who would like to nominate themselves or someone else? Yes, James?
I'll nominate myself.
Okay, so James is nominating himself. Any other nominations? So this, the appropriations chair, and grants, so you'll start in January, and then you'll be able to retire in November 2019, but you're expected to stay in spring 2020, right? Yes. To help the new chair at that time. Any other nominations? Seeing none, James, would you like to introduce yourself, maybe?
Sure. Hey, everyone. I'll make this quick because I'm going to be down here too. First year law student, looking to get more involved with everyone here. I'll reach out and actually about some business explain it a little bit, and I definitely am. So if you think I deserve your vote, will you vote for me? If you don't, I'm sorry, then you can talk about that.
Thank you. So in the interest of time, I will also be taking nominations for the acting chair before we actually go into ballot. So any nominations for yourself or someone else? Yes, Beth.
Would love to nominate Esther.
Okay, Esther. Would you like, okay, so any other nominations first? Okay, seeing none. Esther, can you introduce yourself? Any?
Hi, my name is Esther. I'm a third year business track student here, and I've been serving on the financial committee for a few years now. In fact, I think I'm the oldest serving member of the committee now. And I think we have a few things in mind that we want to do on the ACC. One is to revise or review the existing guidelines. Some of you might know that they are pretty recent. I think only 2 last year. And this is kind of the process of, making like small corrections to serve the better students and the ACSI. So please vote for me if you think that's okay.
Thank you, Esther. So we have James for appropriations chair and Esther for FP chair. Secret ballot should be going around right now. Please write their names if you agree that they should be the chair. If you don't have any confidence in them, you are welcome to write your confidence. And we'll be collecting this. Meanwhile, while you are writing your choice, next on our agenda, we have the Cornell Health Survey results. So as you're writing, we can start looking at the results that you have in the meeting package. And once we collect the ballots, we'll start talking about that. Okay? Is there a second? Okay, is there any dissent? Seeing none, the meeting is extended by 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Okay, so as we're collecting and counting the votes, I would like to start in the interest of time. I'm very sorry that we have to rush through everything today. But I'm sure a lot of you are aware that we've been trying to administer this corona health survey. And I hope everyone got the survey and has done it and have encouraged other people to do it. And just to give you a little bit of a background, what this was actually a collaboration with the student assembly. So it's the undergrad version of us and Cornell Health. So Cornell Health has been helping us in trying to work reading the survey, and they're paying the Survey Research Institute to actually do the survey for us. So thank you, Cornell Health. But at the end of the day, the SA and the GPSA, we own the data, and it's up to us how we want to share the data and how we want to use it. And for those of you who have seen the survey, you know that there were, it's very short, it was only 3-4 questions. And our main sort of like objectives were first to communicate that there is likely an increase in the health e-ownership rates to maintain the current operations of Cornell Health. That was implied in one of the questions. But we also wanted to sort of share different initiatives that Cornell Health have been working on to address mental health and accessibility issues that we have been hearing from a lot of students over the years. So you should have seen those strategies listed if you've done a survey. And we asked students to raise the importance of those initiatives so that we know which ones are more important for students. And then lastly, because Cornell Health have been working on this, they also sort of have an estimate of how much the different strategies actually cost. And we wanted to ask if students were willing to bear the financial cost if we were to administer the initiative immediately, right? I'm very happy that we have 1,099 responses. That's 15% of graduate professional students. I've never seen a higher rate of response in my years here. And we've actually gotten a higher response rate than the undergrads. So that's really great. So you can look at the data here in the meeting package. But just generally, I think this was the most important data of all. So strategy one was hiring more mental health providers. Strategy two, develop online app-based mental health resources. Three is transportation to and from Cornell Health. Four, open Cornell Health on Sundays. And five is integrating mental health support in the academic program. And not surprisingly, we have strategy one, obviously a very high priority for everyone, so more mental health providers. And then that's followed by actually transportation and the integration of mental health support in academic life. And surprisingly to me, at least, is that online mental health resources is fairly low on people's agenda. I think this sends a signal because there have been recently a lot of talks about actually going towards more online-based resources for mental health. And now we know that students are not necessarily, at least at this point, super supportive of that yet. Again, thank you so much, everyone, for doing the survey. In terms of people's willingness to actually increase the rates, I don't think there's anything super interesting there, so essentially what I see is that students who are fully paying for their health e-ownership they're not willing to raise the rates. And then people who are fully funded by the grad school, they are willing to raise. People who are paying in a mixed way have a mixed feelings about the level of increase they're willing to pay for. So I don't think we're getting a very strong signal, at least in that sense. But at least in terms of priority for the different strategies, that's very helpful. And I will present this data at the Friday Student Health Benefit Advisory Committee meeting. And hopefully, we'll be able to make a more informed decision on really how to move forward with the different strategies and how that connects to rate increases. Any questions? Yes.
It would be interesting to know how the breakdown of how people answer the question of how they pay for their student health plan. To know if a majority of people are fully funded by the school or are partially funded or how that affects them. Does that make sense?
What percent are fully paid?
I see.
Yeah.
We have that data. At least in terms of from the people who answer it.
Yeah, that's
I do have the numbers, I just don't have it here ready. But in terms of estimates, the most respondents had this model that they're fully paid.
If the assembly owns the data, as you said, why don't we publish the data set for us? I mean clearly you can slice the dice a lot of ways, and why don't we publish the data set and let people have at it?
Sure, yeah, we can do that. Yes. So you want the raw data. Yeah, sure. So all we don't have names and stuff like that, so it's been totally randomized, so there's no problem with that. Yeah. Any other comments?
Have you reviewed it for another organization? For example, was that department where only 1% answered and you could identify by that? Have you guys actually checked what the data is in fact in our
SRI asked us if we gave you one that identified, we said no.
Okay. But in the sense of were there any de-anonymizing questions that you noticed or
what field are you in and only 3% or
stuff like this? No, we didn't ask any of this question.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, at all. Yeah.
Oh, we're putting the numbers in the essay as well, so that
Just
made sense for a shared undergrad model. So I don't think that there were any questions in the
survey. No, the question was just which of the strategies you found more important, and then how much of an increase are you willing to see, and then how are you paying for your health fee or ship. Okay, Manisha, and then
For those of you who probably didn't have a chance to get to the survey, the questions are in the lead packet or in the link on the agenda. So if you want to go and get the lead packet, we'll go to the lead packet.
I have Kavya, and then we can go back to you.
How was the survey sent out?
Through email. So every single student should have received an email and two reminder emails.
I just wanted to extend the meeting. What should I extend the meeting by 10 minutes?
Five minutes. Okay. Any dissents? None? Okay, 5 more minutes. Yes, any other comments? Okay, and if you have suggestions on how else I could slice the data, that is also very welcome for my presentation to the rest of the committee on Friday. So please let me know. And I think we next have committee updates.
Motion to postpone committee updates open forum and adjourn.
Object because we have to have the result of the election.
Okay. So do we have the result?
Congratulations to James and Hector, you're the
and ACM FC chairs. So there is a motion to adjourn the meeting and not do committee updates and open forum. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there a dissent? Okay, seeing none, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.